Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Mind Shift, the podcast that's here to help you on the journey of deconstruction and discovery. And we do that by helping you to learn how to think critically about such things as the topic of God, the state of the church today, spirituality, and so much more. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm coming to you once again from The Rock, where we live here in North Wales in the United Kingdom. And I'm glad that you've joined me for this episode, which is I'm really excited about today. I'm bringing you the first half of a conversation that I had actually back in December of 2017 with David Madison. And he is the author of a book that came out a couple years ago called 10 Tough Problems in Christian Thought and Belief, A Minister Turned Atheist Shows Why You Should Ditch the Faith. And of course, we're referring here to the Christian faith. What better way to deconstruct your faith by kicking off this new episode of Mind Shift by bringing in a pastor turned atheist. And I'm really excited to bring you today's episode, which, as I say, is the first half of the conversation that I had with David. And I'll be bringing you the conclusion second half next week. As always, I'm interested to hear from you. If you have any thoughts, questions, feedback, comments, whatever, I'd love to hear from you. You can always get a hold of me a variety of different ways in terms of social media, and I'll be talking to you about that after the conversation with David, and I'll also be talking about how you can support the work of Mindshift on Patreon, so stay tuned for that after my discussion with David. And I want to say, too, that in the pilot episode that I released last week, I talked about 7 different categories of people who have left the church, and in fact, it's kind of funny because I've already added another category. And before I get into the conversation with David, I want to just briefly go over those. And this is for a couple of reasons. One, I want to kind of use this as a benchmark or as a model by which to measure my different guests on the show and see where they fall on the spectrum. And this is something that, as I say, it's evolving. It's something that's in process. I started out with about 3 or 4 categories, and through the help of the Unchurching group on Facebook, the Ex-Evangelical group, my post-evangelical writers group page that I started, we've added more and more categories. And as I say, I'm up to 8 now. So nobody really knows how many categories we're going to end up with before this thing is finished. The second reason why I want to go over this real quickly is so that you can find yourself on the spectrum. If this describes you, are you a person that's left the church? But where are you going now? What's your trajectory? What direction are you headed in terms of this spiritual faith journey? And you'll find this article, I'll put a link in the show notes, but you'll find the article on my Theology Corner page. And as I mentioned in last week's episode, this is one of the cool things that's happened just at the end of last year. I was added as a contributor to the Theology Corner network, and this is a great way to interact with all kinds of people from different walks of faith and life. And so check out theologycorner.net. And if you're interested as well in becoming a contributor, send me a message and I'll put you in contact with Mitch Mallory, who is one of the guys who's responsible for starting the Theology Corner blog. All right, so real briefly then, let's just take a look at this from my article, What Happens After People Leave the Church. Now, I've identified kind of 8 groups on the spectrum, and it'll be very interesting to kind of put David Madison up against the scale, and I'll do that after the conversation with David. And as I say, as you listen to me go through these 8, this will help you to figure out where you fall on the spectrum too. And I think it's also quite fascinating to chart your own movement along the spectrum. Maybe you started in one point and then moved to another or another and are in process of moving somewhere else on the scale. Who knows? So I've identified these 8 groups. These are people who really describe the ones who have left the church behind, but what happens after that? So first of all, number 1, we have people who've left the church. And again, this is for a wide variety of reasons. This has to be very heavily nuanced. But this first group definitely identifies themselves as Christians. They still believe in God. They still believe in Jesus and the Bible as the Word of God and so forth. It's just that they want to keep doing church just in different ways. Okay, more organic or less hierarchical. Number two are people who have left the church. They still follow Jesus. They believe in God and the Bible and so forth. Like number one, the difference here is that they don't want to participate in any form of intentional church gathering. They've left the church behind and they don't want to go back. Okay, number three are people who, who have emotionally, perhaps intellectually left the church. It's just that they keep going. They're there every week. Why? Because a spouse, a family member, something like that wants them to attend church. So they're kind of physically present, but they're mentally switched off. They're sitting in the seat or the pew every week, but they're only doing it to please someone else. Now we have number four. This is a different category now. People who have been forced to leave, people who have been forced to quit church by those in leadership. So here we're involved in things like spiritual abuse, sexual abuse, for other reasons. Most of these people, they've not abandoned their Christian faith. They just have major trust issues because of the abuse they've suffered by perhaps people in leadership and so forth. Now we come to number five, and that's ex-evangelicals or ex-evangelicals, people who've left the church. They're in the process of deconstructing their former faith or their Christian faith. Currently, though, they don't know what to believe anymore. They just don't know what to believe, but they don't believe what they used to believe, at least. Then we come to number six, people who have left the church. This is a shift here, people who have given up on God. They've given up on the church as well as God. They become atheists, they become agnostics. They don't want to call themselves Christians. They don't want to go back to the faith. They don't want to go back to the church in any form. Now we have number seven, people who've left the church and now specifically have rejected the Judeo-Christian God. That is the Abrahamic God. Perhaps they're more open now. They're exploring alternative forms of spirituality, other religions, as a life philosophy. Finally, we arrive at number eight, a category that I've just added, and that describes people who've left the church. They've not given up on their beliefs in God per se. So what do I mean they haven't given up their faith in God? Well, this is sort of what I call a modified deist position. So it's kind of like you can have your cake and eat it too. You still believe in God. This is perhaps the God who created everything, or maybe this is the God who started the evolutionary process, whatever you believe. And then he left it to its own devices. This is sort of the cosmic clockmaker. There is a God. He's no longer around, though. Maybe he's just watching us from a distance, as the song says. And so this one perhaps goes a long way towards explaining the problem of evil. You could say, well, God's left humanity to work out its own issues, its own problems, without his help. He's just kind of a hands-off sort of God. And you know, looking at this number eight, I can see where it would be an attractive sort of mediating position. You could leave the church, but you could still believe in a God. It's just that this God has walked away from the universe and really left humanity up to its own devices. So I don't know where you are on the spectrum on that scale of 1 to 8. That's at least where I'm at up to this point. So I'm interested to hear your feedback. And also, as I say, once this interview with David is over, let's come back to this scale and see if we can kind of say, yeah, he's definitely a number whatever on the spectrum. So without further ado, let's get into the conversation that I had with David Madison. And in this episode today, we're going to be delving into David's kind of personal story. I'm very interested to understand how he's made that transition from being a minister, in fact, doing a PhD in biblical studies, and now a full-blown atheist. So how does that happen? And as you hear David's own story, maybe once again, this will sort of resonate with your own journey. If you're on this sort of journey of deconstruction and discovery, what elements of his story sort of resonate with your own story? And do you have the freedom to question some of these things, some of these sacred cows of Christianity, the sacred cows of the Bible, which is what David and I get into in this episode? So I'm very interested to hear what you think. So let's go on into the conversation with David Madison, and let's see if he convinces you to ditch your Christian faith. I am here with Dr. David Madison, or as you prefer, just you go by David. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That is correct. You are coming to us from the Big Apple in New York. You live in, you said Manhattan?
Exactly.
Yes. We love New York. As I was saying to him earlier, we were talking about traveling down there. We did the Big Apple for a couple of days. Got hopelessly lost, by the way, on the New York freeway system. I think that's very easy to do. isn't it? It's a huge city. It can easily get turned around, can't you? Massive place.
You got to know the subway system.
Yeah, we didn't know any of those things. We were hopeless tourists. We were living in Boston at the time and came down on a big trip. And we went through New York for a couple of days and did the Statue of Liberty and Times Square and Ground Zero and all those places. But I love New York. I'd love to go back and visit. So I'm glad you've joined us on this show. We're here to talk about a couple of things, but most importantly, talking about your book. It's called 10 Tough Problems in Christian Thought and Belief. A Minister Turned Atheist Shows Why You Should Ditch the Faith. This is a book that you came out with, what was it, a year and a half ago, David?
Yes, August of 2016 it was published.
Right, and I see by the reviews on Amazon, you're still doing very well, even a year and a half later. You get mostly positive reviews. There's always going to be a few negatives, isn't there?
Absolutely. Interestingly enough, the one of the first reviews was very negative, and the fellow admitted that he had not read the book. He got a lot of pushback from that on that from other readers.
Well, he read the title of the book, it sounds like, and he obviously reacted to it. You get a lot of pushback from conservative Christians who are really irritated and upset by your work?
I set up a Facebook page for my book in 2012, just so I could keep readers up to date with my progress in writing it. And, I do a paid boost for the book every Friday night just to raise awareness of it. And I get a lot of reaction from Christians who are very upset. What problems? There aren't any problems. What are you talking about? And
wow.
When I point out that Christian theologians have been wrestling with these problems for centuries, they seem not to know that. And they seem to, they must have solved all these problems, which of course has not happened at all.
And why is it, do you think, that so many Christians out there are just not familiar with even the historic debates and like you say, theological conundrums that theologians have wrestled with for centuries? You can go back and read Aquinas and Augustine and people like that. They were wrestling with the problem of evil and philosophical problems, the existence of God, centuries ago. So this is not a new subject by any stretch of the imagination, is it?
No, not at all. One thing that puzzles me about Christians, and I suppose it could be said about it, people of any faith, the lack of curiosity. When I was writing this book, 10 Tough Problems, I never once had any Christian say to me, there are problems, 10 problems, what are they? No curiosity. They don't want anybody to make waves. It's
right.
Been taught to them since children, and how could it be wrong?
Right.
Of course,
there are no
if
problems.
They have questions or doubts, they go to their priests or pastor, and I've always warned people that if you go to your priest or your pastor, you're talking to the wrong people because they are paid propagandists.
Right. It's in their best interest to keep the machine going, as it were.
They're trained, they're hired to help people snuff out doubts. But if you just start exploring it, then the difficulties begin to stand out.
Now, I'm interested to find out, we kind of talked a little bit before we started hitting the recording button, and we said that we were interested in sort of breaking it up into two halves, this interview. One of the first things I wanted to talk about was your own personal story, because what I found interesting reading a little bit of your bio, you've done a PhD in biblical studies. You were a pastor yourself for, what, about 9 years?
That's correct.
Yeah, so how does a person who was, you were in the system, you were academics, you were in pastoral ministry, so how do you go from being one of those paid professionals, as you say, designed to snuff out questions and objections, to now being an atheist, actually now writing a book on 10 tough problems? Can you kind of walk us through your own story?
Well, yeah, my background is this. I was raised in a small town in northern Indiana, and my mother was very devout. She was not a fundamentalist. It's always kind of a mystery to me that here she was, born in 1905 in Terre Haute, Indiana, and was not a fundamentalist. My father was a physician. They both believed in evolution. They would have thought it was eccentric not to believe in evolution. And my mother was not a biblical literalist. She would often say, well, you can't take that literally. You can't take that literally. And when I was a teenager, she bought a huge set of books called The Interpreter's Bible, 12 big volumes. And this was written from the liberal Protestant perspective. That is, it wasn't fundamentalism. It wasn't evangelical perspective of the Bible is without errors, these Protestant scholars, for the most part in the Interpreter's Bible, they analyzed the Bible critically, analytically. And when they saw something that they thought didn't make sense, they said so. So that was the atmosphere in which I was nurtured, and I went off to college with that kind of approach. But in seminary, you know, my mother was a voracious reader. She never went to college, but she read so much, and that reading habit really sank in with me. But when I got to college, just the idea, there's no question you're not supposed to avoid. And when I was in seminary, one of my professors, well, just a little background here, Karl Barth was a theologian in the middle of the 19th century who wrote a 13-volume work called Church Dogmatics. He was a Swiss scholar, so he wrote in German. This huge, it took him 30 years to write, it's called Church Dogmatics.
Yes, I've tried to read it.
but one of my professors in theology class, when we were studying Karl Barth, he said, nobody knows 8,000 pages about God, not even in German. and that provokes the question, or it should, well, how do you know even one page about God? Where do you get that information? Where is the reliable, verifiable data about God? And so that started my thought processes. All the things we say we rely on, prayer and meditation and visions, scripture, none of that is reliable, verifiable. It's all very subjective. And then the other thing, and one of my professors said, what is the value of a 40-day resurrection? And by that he meant the ascension as described in the book of Acts, for example, Jesus leaving planet Earth. Well, that never could have happened. As we now know, there's no place up there for Jesus to go. So obviously he died again. If you accept the resurrection story, he died again and then was buried again. And so my professor said, what is the value of a 40-day resurrection? And that was another thing that kind of chipped away at some of the basic aspects of my faith. And even in seminary, I wrote a paper just for my own, get my own thoughts down on paper on the improbability of God. And I showed that to one of my classmates who was not pleased, didn't show it to anybody else. But that I look back on that now and I see how my thought was progressing. So that by the time I finished my PhD in biblical studies, I'd become an atheist.
As Hector Avalos said, it was actually the Bible that turned me into an atheist. Sounds like it's kind of part of your own journey, isn't it? Where you're having these questions.
Penn Jillette has said that the fast track to atheism is reading the Bible.
Yeah, so it's a similar kind of a deconstruction process. It's interesting that, okay, your description is very different than my upbringing, even though we both did a PhD in biblical studies. We were both pastors of a church. I come out of a very fundamentalist background. So in a way, maybe you were lucky that your mom was exposed to that more classic liberal theology, because I'm thinking 1905, that would have been right around the early years of the fundamentalist liberal debates and all those things around the turn of the century, wasn't it? So she could have been cast out of certain denominations for even having those biblical commentaries that she had.
Well, I think that series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals, upon which the term fundamentalism is based, I think those came out in the 19-teens.
Yeah, it was 1910, I think, or so. Yeah, right around there.
But Harry Emerson Fosdick, who was a liberal Protestant pastor who founded Riverside Church here in New York, he was very active in the 1920s and 30s. In fact, his sermons would be written up in the New York Times.
I was going to say one of my favorite sermons is his sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win? And a lot of his comments that he makes in, I think it came out in 1922, a lot of the statements he makes in that sermon could be said of the same kind of arguments that are even taking place today between what we call progressive Christianity, I guess you could say, and the more hardline conservative evangelicals. So it seems like the culture war is still certainly not over, is it, by any stretch?
Oh, it's alive and well, vigorously.
Definitely. So now this is interesting. You, going back to your story, so you come out of this PhD in biblical studies. By this time, you say you're a confirmed atheist, but was it then that you went into being a pastor of this church?
No, I had done most of my pastoring by the time I'd finished the PhD.
Oh, right. So you're doing it at the same time?
Yeah.
Right. So what was your experience being a pastor as far as it relates to your own sort of journey of deconstruction, this journey of traveling towards becoming an atheist. Did you find any conflict of interest there in terms of what you were, you know, supposed to preach and teach and all these things, your expectations?
Well, it was a very difficult transition because as belief is eroding, there were things I was hanging on to. For example, the great contemporary of Karl Barth was Paul Tillich. And Tillich was even said at one point, God cannot be strictly speaking, God cannot be said to exist because that would be a limiting factor. And God was the ground of all being. Well, you know, I was hanging on to that as a way of retaining the idea of God. Everybody in the pews I was talking to on Sunday, God was the man upstairs. God was the man they sang songs to and praised. So after a while, you know, I just knew I could not pursue the ministry as a career, and I made a transition into a business career.
Right.
But over the years, you know, my thoughts just kept turning. I was like, how can people still take this seriously? And it was, you know, around 2010, 2012 that I began saying, let me put all of these problems I see with Christianity into 10 buckets and write them up that way. And so that's how my book finally evolved.
Yeah, I can definitely resonate in this, what you're talking about when you were a pastor and struggling with this, as your own faith perhaps is eroding away, you have doubts. You can't necessarily voice those doubts, can you, in terms of a congregation? I can remember years ago when I was a pastor in Portland, in Oregon, going to a good friend of mine and saying, this is my problem, is that I'm not sure if I believe in the product that I'm selling here. And I don't know if that resonates with you at all, but it's difficult because, you know, ideally, if you're a preacher, let's say, you're supposed to get up there and have all this conviction that what you believe is the truth and you need them to believe it as well. But if you don't necessarily believe it, it's hard to fake that conviction, isn't it? Every Sunday when you're standing in the pulpit proclaiming whatever it is, the truth from the Bible, this is a very difficult place to be in, isn't it?
Well, you resort to the, it's a metaphor. It's, you have to look for the quote unquote deeper meaning. I've been reading through some of my diaries that I wrote at the time, and there are some places where I'm very candid about how much I hate to preach about Easter because the resurrection faith is, I say now it belongs more to Halloween than to Easter. It's a ghoulish superstition. How do you preach about that? Well, you resort to it's symbolic. It's a metaphor, but trust me, the people in the pews, it's not a metaphor and it's not symbolic. They take it seriously.
Well, it's so much a part of people's identity, isn't it? Their faith, they're hugely emotionally threatened when you start to question some of the core doctrines, right? I mean, you were saying, what's the point of a 40-day resurrection? I mean, now that I think back on it, I spent a lot of time studying apologetics when I was a staunch conservative evangelical. That was the world I was raised in. And then I became an elder and a pastor. And I can remember thinking at the time, why is this? It's such an elusive thing because there's all these arguments about the historicity of it and the appearances of Jesus and so forth. And it's all debated and argued. And why couldn't they just make it a bit more clear? Why 40 days with all these with all the mystery surrounding it? And then people would say, well, that's where faith comes in. You know, that seems to be the stock answer, doesn't it? It's just, well, you just have to believe on faith.
Yeah.
And somehow that's not always the satisfying answer, is it?
No, not at all. You know, somebody has said, I forget who, why did he just show up to his closest associates? Why didn't he appear to, this would have been a good thing. Why didn't he appear to Pilate? Why didn't he appear to Herod? Why didn't he go to Rome and appear to people? Why doesn't he keep appearing?
Yeah, why only 40
century
days?
Century after century.
And then disappear.
You know, that would be a way to convince people. Just keep showing up.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? So much of this does come down to, well, you just simply have to believe it on faith. But what if that isn't good enough for somebody who wants a bit more empirical evidence? Maybe the evidence may not be there, or maybe not satisfactorily enough to tip the balance to what? What's the alternative? Because people are so afraid to give that. That's a core doctrine, you know. If you give that up, you know, that's what the fundamentalists argued. You've given up all of Christianity. The whole edifice comes crashing down, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's then it just becomes a shadow of its former self. And then why bother?
Yeah, why bother?
But the faith argument is undermined by the fact that, what are there, 30 or 40,000 different sects of Christianity now?
Yeah, so many denominations and traditions.
Divisions, sects, denominations, cults, they all have faith, but they have faith in something that they don't all agree on.
Yeah,
Muslims have faith that their version of the truth is the right one. Catholics have their faith that their version of Christianity is the true one. I could propose that there is a race of priests that live on the far side of the moon in cities under the surface. I could preach that religion.
Yeah.
And there are enough gullible people out there who would probably believe me.
Well, look at...
And donate to my cause.
Yeah, I was going to say that's similar to what Scientology teaches, basically, isn't
yeah.
it? It's a science fiction religion.
And people say, oh, you just have to have faith that it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
The burning in the bosom, whatever it might be. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because something I've been, a concept that I've been toying with lately is I've been struggling with the whole concept of Christianity. And my analogy, I'd be interested to see what your thoughts on this were. My analogy is that it's like a kernel and the husk around that kernel. You know, there's a seed inside and then there's all these layers of a husk around it. And I'm thinking there's problems with both of those. So if you said that the seed was sort of the essence of pure Christianity, the historical Jesus or whatever, that's the kind of the seed of the gospel. But then there's been so many layers of tradition built up and doctrine and dogmas and confessions and creeds around that seed that it's you can't even see it. It's completely unrecognizable. And there's problems with the seed aspect of it because, as you say in your book, you have to question the historicity of the Bible, the Gospels, and the traditions and all that. But then, what about all the layers and layers and denominations that have taken place since the first century to what it's become today? It's a virtually unrecognizable thing. So, to me, there's kind of two aspects to this whole thing. What do you make of that kind of kernel and husk sort of metaphor? Does that strike any, you know, bells with you?
Yes, of course, but I think we're becoming more and more aware that the seed might not have existed at all.
Right, and that's what I'm saying.
Mean,
you've got to question that aspect
Richard
of it as
Carrier
well.
And David Fitzgerald make a very good case that the historical Jesus probably was no such thing. But even if you're a secular historian, say, yes, there's enough evidence there to suggest that Jesus did exist. Well, that doesn't get you very far because the Gospels are totally unreliable. And I do mean totally. And by that I mean we do not know what sources the Gospels writers used. We do know that Matthew and Luke copied Mark. And
yeah,
we're pretty sure Mark was a pretty lousy historian. But
yeah.
The bottom line is that there is no contemporary documentation at all for anything Jesus said or did. No contemporary documentation. If I want to write a biography of an historical person, you pick out the person, whether it's Darwin or Lincoln or Napoleon or whatever. You have to find the contemporary documentation, the letters, the newspaper articles that can document what that historical person did or said. There's none of that whatever for Jesus. It's totally missing. The Gospels were created decades later. And they are propaganda pieces. They are designed to get people to believe.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Like you say, there's the synoptic problem as well as a lot of these other things that Christian biblical scholars have been talking about for centuries, haven't they? Ever since they noticed that there were both similarities and key differences in all, well, certainly those three Gospels, and then you got John. These have been huge problems for biblical scholars for a long, long time, haven't they? But as you say, most Christians would say, well, they've solved all those problems. They're all solved now. They've
well,
just, you know, harmonization of the Gospels, it's all been fixed.
They're just not aware of them. They hear snippets of the Gospels read in Sunday service, or they see the Gospel stories put up on stained glass window, or quotes from Jesus on greeting cards, but in terms of really studying the Gospels, reading them word for word, being aware of the problems. I tell people, take 3 hours to read the Gospel of Mark. Just read straight through the Gospel of Mark. then turn to the Gospel of John. You're in a totally different world. They're not the same person. The bare outlines of some of the career described may be similar, but they're not the same person. They can't be. The huge monologues of Christ in John's Gospel do not exist at all in the other Gospels. Where did he get all this stuff? He made it up. He was a theologian.
Yeah, I remember I used to teach New Testament, and we used to go through this synoptic problem, and I used to have the students read parallel passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and write all the similarities as well as the differences down, which that's fairly easy to do. As you say, you can read through the Gospels. You can say, okay, there's some things in here that aren't in the other two. Some of the things are in all three, and they go through it, and that's easy enough. But then when you get to the questions of how do you account for these differences, then the problems really begin to mount, don't they? Because the answers become kind of more and more fantastical. And it was, I think for a lot of certainly these first year students, that was the first time they'd ever been confronted with those sort of similarities as well as pretty stark differences, especially as you say, when you get into John, which has a lot of stuff that's not in the other three at all. So yeah, this is a huge problem.
One example I like to use is the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. In Mark's gospel, it's described in about one verse, two verses at most. Just, he was in the desert for 40 days. He was tempted by the devil. He was ministered to by the angels. Period. End of story. What did Matthew do with that? He has a huge chunk. He adds the dialogue between Jesus and Satan. An extensive dialogue. Well, a historian has to ask, where did Matthew get that? Did he interview the devil? Where did these words come from? There was no eyewitness present there to have written it all down. Matthew made it up.
Oh,
I'm writing an article now that's going to go up on the Debunking Christianity blog Christmas week, in which I talk about the Sermon on the Mount. I just say, think about it, people. How in the world can you say these are the words of Jesus? Because 95% of the people who heard him speak were illiterate. They did not carry around pads of paper and pencils. They didn't have iPhones. How were his words recorded in the first place? And just assuming that someone remembered them, kind of, who could write them down dead accurately a day or two later? And if you're going to rely on oral tradition, stories about Jesus being told orally for 30 or 40 years, well, you know how garbled that becomes. And then there's the whole problem of Jesus speaking in Aramaic and the Gospels are in Greek. You know, there's no way that the Sermon on the Mount really derives from Jesus. It's made up stuff.
Yeah, or as you say, if he did preach a Sermon on a Mount, whether or not what he actually said in time and space is exactly what's then recorded later in the Gospels, you have to question that. I mean, you could say the same thing about the first couple chapters of Genesis too, couldn't you? Here's the author of Genesis saying this happened at creation and so on and so forth. But one of the questions I used to ask my students was, let's take a minute and analyze this from a narratological point of view and say, what kind of information is the narrator providing us? How do we know? Where did he get that information? How do we know where did he receive that from? Was he there? Well, he clearly couldn't have been there at creation as he describes it. Yeah, I had a lot of students ask me whether or not I was a Christian. And I was teaching at a theological school over here in the UK. But I'm just trying to get people to think and ask critical questions. And that's going back to that deconstructing the seed. Because like you say, there's a lot of questions we have to ask about the text. Now, of course, I was going to say the stock answer, of course, David, is, well, it's inspired. That's why. That's the ultimate trapdoor answer, isn't it? Because the reason that we know we have the words of Jesus 100% accurately is because the authors of Scripture were guided by the Holy Spirit such that they wrote everything down exactly, correctly, accurately. And that's why we have this inerrant Bible. I mean, isn't that the stock sort of answer that you get?
Response I have is, you really don't want to go there, because then God becomes responsible for all of the contradictions and errors and blunders and goofs. Do you really want to go there? Because you don't You can read the Gospels and see the mistakes right in front of you. Do you want to blame that all on God? If God is the author of the Gospels, then God sucks as an author.
He's not a very good author.
That's the bottom.
Well, this was another thing that I used to torment my students with, and that was we used to get into this discussion about what percent of the Bible would you attribute to God and how much of it would you attribute to humans? Because clearly somebody wrote something down on a piece of parchment or papyrus or whatever. So is it 100% God, 0% humans, or 100% human, 0% God, or any variation on that spectrum? Because no matter which percentage you settle on, it solves certain problems, but what it does is it creates other problems. As you say, if you say 100% God, 0% human, you end up with a dictation, mechanical writing sort of thing. And then if there are any mistakes, then it's on God's shoulders, isn't it? It's God's fault.
Well, yeah, but in the third chapter of my book, I talk about precisely this problem. If the authors were inspired, then the human brain is the instrument that God used. But then how do you know that you look at a particular verse and you say, I'm sure that this verse came from the mind of God rather than the mind, the person who owned the brain. But how do you know that? It comes back to the basic question of epistemology. How do you know which verse comes from God, which verse comes from man? And you look at some of the verses in the Bible and they're pretty bad. You were mentioning Hector Avalos earlier. One of the great quotes of Hector Avalos is, going verse by verse, 99% of the Bible would not be missed. And I think most lay people who've made the valiant effort to read the Bible cover to cover, they may not say so, but if there were an anonymous poll taken, I think most Christians would say the same thing. There's just too much there that's not worthy to be considered holy scripture, quote unquote.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we were talking about earlier about going back to the fundamentalists and the liberals at the end of the 19th century and on into the 20th century, I've been doing a lot of research on the subject of this doctrine of inerrancy. And one of the things that comes out, well, it really comes out of the late 19th century as a response to, as you were mentioning, German liberal scholarship, even Karl Barth and some of the other neo-Orthodox scholars questioning the scriptures and things. And so the fundamentalists crafted this doctrine of inerrancy to kind of create an airtight argument, I think, to where they've essentially, though, painted themselves into a corner because they, by necessity, they have to defend 100% of the Bible, even to ridiculous lengths, because if they admit one mistake, then their whole faith actually comes crashing down. And it's such a huge house of cards that I think, man, are you sure you want to adopt this position if you're an inerrantist because the stakes are so high? This seems like a huge insurmountable problem to me.
Well, Bart Ehrman, he described exactly that process because he went into biblical studies with the inerrancy point of view, and it didn't take him long to figure out, well, it really can't be because there are such obvious errors. And that's what led him on the path eventually to atheism, although Bart Ehrman, he was pushed more in that direction by the problem of evil and the problem of suffering.
Even conservative scholars, I mean, they say, well, actually, their argument is inerrancy is confined to the original autographs. That's how they get around it. There's a couple of backdoor escapes. One of them is, well, we don't have those original autographs, but we have textual criticism, which reconstructs the text with some sort of 98% degree accuracy, and they go on, you know, down this line. But I read one article that said, actually, the problem is Christians have overcommitted to the Bible. So they've overcommitted, and that's led them to places like biblicism, bibliolatry, fideism, special pleading, and other things to get out of some of those problems that they encounter. So there's all these sort of backdoor escape routes that they can conveniently take to whenever there's a significant problem.
Well, in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, Protestants were accused of having a paper pope, relying too much on the reliability of the Bible.
Yeah, replacing the pope with the
Bible.
You know,
on the issue of the, well, it's the originals that were that didn't have any errors or mistakes in them. Well, if God went to all that trouble to make sure that those original documents didn't have any mistakes in them, why weren't the manuscripts preserved?
Where are they? Well, they.
Where are they? Why weren't they?
Yeah, their answer
there's
is.
There's no such thing as the original Bible somewhere in a monastery in the Middle East. That
yeah.
Exists.
One of my guests said maybe it's under glass in the Vatican somewhere. I don't know. We just don't know about it yet.
But my question is, why didn't God arrange for Gutenberg to come along 1,600 years earlier and
invent the printing press?
And with the printing press so that the hand copying of manuscripts couldn't plague the Bible so much.
What a thought-provoking conversation. Definitely makes you think about some of these sacred cows that Christianity has long had to prop up, really, because its whole system, its whole house of cards depends on keeping these core dogmas and doctrines intact. But once you question things like the Bible, or as we get into next week, more specifically, the existence of God and the problem of evil and what that does to the Christian faith, it really can rattle your whole foundation. And really, that's the whole point, I think, is questioning these sacred cows, questioning some of these sacred dogmas. And if you, too, are on the journey of deconstruction and discovery, I hope that this episode has proved to be challenging and thought-provoking for you. Now, one of the things I said I was going to do after the conversation with David was to go back to my model of 8 different groups who have left the church or Christianity behind and see if we can't place him somewhere along that spectrum. I would definitely say we can rule out numbers 1 through 5. He is definitely not someone who identifies as a Christian. So I would say at this point, we can definitely say David is a number 6 on the scale and possibly edging into number 7. We haven't had enough evidence put forth from his side to make that conclusive claim yet. But I think after next week, when we get into the very specific issue of the problem of evil, reconciling the question of how can a good and loving, all-powerful God do nothing to stop all kinds of evil that we see in the world today, and what that specifically raises in terms of problems for the Christian faith, we are going to see perhaps he is more in that number 7 category. So stay tuned next week, come back and listen to the next episode where we finish the conversation with David Madison and talk about the problem of evil and some of the real specific issues within Christianity. All right, one of the things I want to do before I let you go is, as I mentioned, there's a variety of ways you can get a hold of me on social media platforms. You can send me an email and I'll respond back to you. You can email me, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. I would also encourage you to stop by and like my Facebook page, the MindShift podcast page, and that is found at facebook.com/MindShiftPodcast. You can also follow me on Instagram at MindShiftPodcast. And finally, one last thing I'll mention before I let you go, and that is if you have found the work of MindShift Podcast or the Preacher's Forum blog helpful to you at all in terms of your own journey of deconstruction and discovery, you can consider supporting my work for as little as $1 a month. After all, what can you even buy for $1 a month? Hardly anything. But with that dollar a month, you can not only support the work of MindShift and the Preacher's Forum blog, you can also gain access to the closed private MindShift podcast group on Facebook. And there's going to be some more rewards coming out for supporters on Patreon as well in 2018. For more information, you can go to patreon.com/MindShiftPodcast. And there's more information and a video that will explain a little bit more about what I am trying to do with this podcast as well as my writing. So as I let you go, don't forget next week is the second half of the conversation with David Madison. The following week, I'm going to be switching gears a lot and we're going to be bringing you a discussion that I had with Richard Jacobson. He is the author of a book called Unchurching Christianity without churchianity. So we're going to hear a completely different point of view in a couple of weeks from Richard Jacobson. I think he's going to be definitely in that number one category on my list, but I'll reserve judgment until we hear from Richard. So be sure and come back next week for part two with David Madison and join me, your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, right here on Mindshift.